We have to remember that those white settlers who came to California, or gold or otherwise, had 2 centuries of Indian warfare behind them. And they did embark on an effort to exterminate Indian culture and lives, not transform it in a sense as the Spanish actually expected to do. And after the establishment of California as a state, raids on Indians by whites killed at least 15,000 people in 2 decades. And of course, there are other sordid activities. U.S. citizens followed the Spanish custom of kidnapping Indian children. Thousands were taken and apprenticed to various employees, and the old Spanish custom of raping squaws became an established Yankee practice. So in California and across the country, therefore, for roughly 4 centuries, Europeans and white Americans, white U.S. citizens, engaged in an unbroken string of genocidal campaigns against the native people of the Americas. And I would argue that what Holocaust survivor, writer, and Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel asserted about the Nazis and the Holocaust in Europe is relevant to our understanding of what happened in America, and that is the absolutely central role of religion. And I quote him, "All the killers," he's speaking now about the Holocaust in Europe, "all the killers were Christian. The Nazi system was the consequence of a movement of ideas and followed a strict logic. It did not arise in a void and had its roots deep in a tradition. This was inseparable from the past of Christian civilized Europe." So therefore, to understand what happened in what is now the United States, what was inflicted on native peoples who were here, who had their own contradictions and their own violence and struggles and wars between various tribes or nations. We're not romanticizing what went on here, but we're talking about the fundamental clash of Europeans with those who were already here. It is necessary to examine the core of European thought and culture, especially Christianity. To many European Christians, the Indians were thought to be barbarians. In the original Greek, barbarophonoi, those whose speech sounded like barbar to the Greeks. Those who could not speak Greek were barbarians. That's where the word comes to us from, by the way. So the racist attacks against these barbarians emerges from the same roots, number of scholars argue, standard among them, that these attacks here in what is now the United States, California, upstate New York, where I used to live, Michigan, Illinois, I mean, just go through the states, by the way, that have Indian names, okay? Massachusetts, Connecticut, Ohio, etc. That the roots that created and that these attacks, racist attacks, emerged from the same roots that created and nourished attacks against Jews in medieval Europe. That anti-Semitism and racism against native peoples are but 2 sides of the same coin. A belief in the inherent superiority and inferiority of groups of people not subject to change and given to us by some divine providence. Now, anti-Semitism in Europe, must be recalled, was advocated by some of the great religious leaders that we read about, that we learned to admire because of their challenge to the Catholic Church. None other than Martin Luther. Remember Martin Luther, the 95 Theses, he banged on the door, he challenged Catholicism, etc. We've all studied the Protestant Reformation, Protestantism, a protest, right? Well, who knew Martin Luther was an absolute virulent anti-Semite? Okay? I mean, he would have been right at home in the SS in the 1940s. He called Jews a plague, a pestilence, useless, evil, pernicious people, tricky serpents, assassins, and children of the devil, among other things, and mad dogs. And he urged violence against them, including the burning of synagogues. So a number of scholars argue that, as with Jews in the Middle Ages, Europeans dehumanized and demonized American Indians in the process of exterminating them. And that, because we can't undo history, we must now try to understand why and how this happened, and how the lies and mystification about history based in our schooling and the mass media have blocked our critical awareness of what actually went on, so that we can understand and reject what has really been a generation after generation of lies and distortions. Now, the racist views of American Indians were put forth by eminent historians. Okay? We're not talking about just, you know, someone they just pick off the street, some guy who, you know, has certain prejudices. We're talking about eminent historians, dominant historians, who referred to native territories as empty space, wilderness, vast chaos, unopened land, virgin land. I mentioned Samuel Eliot Morison. Arguably the most famous historian in the first half of the United States in the 20th century, and our admiring biographer of Columbus, he dismissed Native Americans as pagans expecting short and brutish lives, void of any hope for the future. They were Stone Age savages. Therefore, the assault on the supposedly uncivilized people came, for example, despite a social life, for example, among Eastern Europeans, especially the Iroquois Confederacy, that attracted the admiration of some European observers. Scholars point out that the Iroquois League, in what is now upstate New York in Canada, and I lived in Ithaca, New York, and there are a number of little historical markers around Ithaca. A number of them were General Sullivan in 1779 during our Revolutionary War, on direct orders from General George Washington, came through and destroyed virtually every Cayuga Nation village, because the Cayuga was sympathetic with the British. Okay. They even burned down fields and trees in Aurora, New York. It's about 30 miles north of Ithaca. It's called Peach Town. Okay. Thousands of Cayuga died. I never learned that until some time ago. Well, some ideas out of the Iroquois League were directly or indirectly responsible for things like the public meeting tradition, free speech, democracy, and a number of things that actually got attached to the Bill of Rights. And a strong argument has been made that some of the ideas influenced the founding fathers about constitutional principles, especially in the earlier Articles of Confederation. But the Iroquois social life was much too radical for even the most advanced framers of the Constitution. The United States did not have full women's suffrage until 1920, although it was fundamental to the Iroquois Confederacy. There was an equality between men and women that did not exist in the United States. We still have capital punishment, which the Iroquois Confederacy had simply abolished. And the concern for child welfare among the Iroquois Confederacy and other American Indian nations that was very prominent did not really arise in the United States until the 20th century. So these were the savages and the uncivilized people. So in essence, what we've learned And it's hard actually to find the words, given 500 years of destruction. And first you destroy a people, then you have to tell stories. And of course, the winners tell the stories. And it's the stories that now we're left with that we need to struggle with. What essentially Zinn is telling us in this book, and what others have argued, is that we've really learned a Eurocentric, well, especially a male Eurocentric view of America. As one geographic historian says, a set of beliefs about reality that educated and usually unprejudiced Europeans and European Americans accept as proposition supported by the fact. But we have to ask, how is it that Eurocentric historical statements which are not valid? Because I would argue that any systematic scholarly study of the history since Columbus landed here, in which you follow the facts, or in many cases follow the money, but you follow the facts, where the facts lead you, and if the facts interfere with our preconceived prejudices and stereotypes, then we have a decision, you know, a decision of conscience. Are we going to follow what the facts tell us, or are we going to follow what we would like to believe and continue in our denial? So in a sense, we have learned to follow Eurocentric historical statements that are not valid, not confirmed by evidence, and sometimes contradicted by evidence. Yet they continue to survive as accepted beliefs for generations and even centuries, over and over. They're reproduced, and it's not that, especially in terms for those of us who have been involved with the educational system, it's not that people are, you know, getting up with an evil intention, but it's reflected in, I worked with more than 6,000 students, mainly in a program of teacher education at a college in New York, and out of those 6,000, maybe 1,200, 1,500 were teachers who had to get their master's degree, and very, very, very few had a critical understanding of the kinds of things we're talking about here. I mean, I had to go back after graduate school and as a professor to relearn a lot of these things. So it's not that they were trying to do a trip on their students. They simply were not given the critical tools to understand these issues so they could help their young students think critically about these issues. So Zinn is challenging every major assumption about Columbus and Eurocentrism. That is, essentially, he is challenging the colonizer's model of the world. This is the model we've been taught, and we've been taught this model, I believe, and I argue that he's arguing this, so that we will ultimately support the oppressors and not the oppressed. Because as Zinn says, in the inevitable taking of sides in history, you have to, by the way, take a side. Okay? There's no such thing as being neutral in history. Being neutral is a place. Being in the middle of an argument is taking a position. And as the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire argued many years ago, in the struggle between the powerful and the powerless, to be neutral is to side with the powerful. Always. So that in the inevitable taking of sides, and Zinn takes sides, okay? There's no doubt about that. Okay? Of course he's taking a side. Everyone who writes about history, sociology, injustice, justice, whatever, takes a side. But in the inevitable taking of sides, he's arguing that if we accept the dominant view uncritically and do not challenge it, we essentially become mute and passive in the face of injustice. And that's the essence of the argument in the first chapter.
You're listening to a lecture series from a public class on American history given by Professor John Marciano. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3 Lancaster, Radio Veronica.us West Point, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude with a class discussion that followed Marciano's lecture based on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Get some reflections, thoughts, jump in.
So as you were just saying, I mean, the establishment history is that, you know, the natives were conquered in the name of some idea of progress. And, you know, what you're saying is that there was a, you know, there's a heavy, you know, Christian crusade element, racist element to what was done to the indigenous peoples here, as well as, you know, what was done to Jews, gypsies and others, you know, by the Nazis. But it seems to me that, you know, that you know, from what Zinn's saying here as well, that there was, while religion may be a justification, it wasn't necessarily the motive. And the motive is always and, you know, forever will be some form of commerce or financial motive. And people came here for gold and slaves. And there's it wasn't called capitalism back then, but you know, can we distinguish between a justification that was used, but then a deeper motive, or you know, are we reducing, you know, these horrors that were done to religion? And not getting to maybe a deeper financial. I mean, to reduce Nazism to just racism ignores the fact that, you know, fascism and Nazism by definition is extreme capitalism and extreme, you know, co-optation of government by big business with a racist overtone as the justification for the people. I mean, maybe anyone could comment on that. Or John,
well,
you can.
I mean, I ended up in terms of I'm all wired or whatever here, I don't know, emphasizing some of the ideological aspects, but you're absolutely right in that there was a tangible, Columbus and others came here and had a certain belief structure about the world, everyone does. In the same way the slave traders. I mean, you don't have the continuation of the slave trade, Africa, the triangle trade to the Caribbean and up to the U.S., etc., and building of thousands of ships and outfitting these ships and paying the men on the ships very, very little, of course, unless there was some profit in that trade. It would have been totally, it wasn't this irrational desire that they just somehow hated black people and they just wanted to go get a bunch of people and own, right? It was a whole social relationship. And in one of the books that'll be on the reading list later, Eric Williams, who actually I believe was the prime minister of Barbados or one of the islands in the Caribbean, has a marvelous work on capitalism and slavery. So the conquerors who came expected to go back, and we know from their own records, their own logs, they were looking for gold, they wanted to take gold, and of course you have the whole ideological overlay of religion, a justification. You need a rationalization to do what clearly they knew were horrible things. Okay, I mean, you have to find some way to justify, because they thought they were doing good, evidently. I mean, evidently, if they felt in their heart of hearts they weren't, I mean, some of them would have stopped. So there is this connection between ideas and material resources. And as one of my students said, you know, somebody's got to get something tangible back out of all of this. And that plunder by the way, that plunder from the New World, this is the New World, helped build the Industrial Revolution and capitalism in Europe. I mean, you know, huge. I mean, we don't know how much. Immense resources. It's still going on, of course. The resources being taken from Asia, Africa, the most, and Latin America, and moved to Japan, North, you know, Europe, and the United States. So this is, think of it as a 500-year plunder. That's what it was. Primitive accumulation. That's what Marx talked about.
Hi. My name is Bernadette. What I'd like to do is go back to when you were giving your original presentation and pick up one of the threads. You said that the American Indians actually had a democratic, were democratically organized and so on. I came across an idea that coincides with that in the book. I don't remember the title of it. I don't remember the author. But I do remember that the author's first book was The Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. Whatever book he wrote after that, pardon? Okay, whatever Robert wrote after that, after The Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. And what he presents in that is that in Europe, they had all these salons with all the rich people entertaining themselves, pretty much like the wealthy universities now. Harvard University will have people come speak who won a gold medal in the Olympics, or because places like the Ivy League universities can support having speakers who are of interest. So, and even you could even look at this group now as a salon meeting. At any rate, what the author presented was that these explorers would go into America, and then they would be in, when they went back to Europe, they would be invited back to these salons, and they would be expressing and telling how the Indians thought, because don't forget, we never really learned how they thought. And how they thought happened to be, guess what? The basis for the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity, and then the basis for the American Constitution and so on. And to me, that was such a mind-blowing idea. And I thought, oh, isn't that cool? The people who are originally here were really the people who are responsible for our present structure of government. And that's all I want to say, except I would appreciate you giving me the spelling of that author's name again. What did you say? The one who wrote The Art of... How do you spell his last name?
P-I-R-S-I-G.
And just a quick note that essentially I was discussing the Iroquois Confederacy because given the location of the 13 colonies in the Eastern Seaboard, that it's the an interaction with the Iroquois Confederacy and others that in terms of the research I've been able to do, it's out of that there was an impact. Rather than because there was very little contact, of course, with the Indian nations of the plains and the West, but especially the Cayuga, the Onondaga, and this mostly in upstate, what is now upstate New York, from the far reaches almost to Lake Erie across to near the Hudson River. And Benjamin Franklin writes about this. These ideas. I didn't know about the... So these guys would go back to Europe and sort of be celebrated. And I mean, I know they were celebrated in a way, but sort of sit around and tell other people what was going on. Yeah. Well, but nobody's going to invite us to Harvard. But hey,
I was confused by something you were saying when I walked in a little bit late. You said something about Columbus setting a precedent in world history for... It sounded like you were saying that his manner of conquest and was set a precedent in world history, and I don't understand because expansion by conquest had been going on for thousands
of
years.
But in terms of the connection between, scholars argue, in terms of the connection between Europe and the Americas, to initiate the transatlantic slave trade. Because you're right. Go back. We even see this when we saw it in the film version, or some of us may have read Howard Fast's Spartacus. This didn't start with, you think of the Romans, you think of the Greeks, you think of Alexander, you think of, blanking on the Mongols, Attila the Hun, etc. Yeah, Columbus was, he sort of was following a rich tradition in history.
Yeah.
But in terms of the connection with Europe and the Americas, because very little, even though we have some evidence that the Vikings may have been here in Labrador and so on, but the essential slave trade and the real conquest of the Americas, scholars argue that's Columbus's fundamental role. He was one of the first. I mean, there may have been someone before. I mean, we learn about him. And we learned, of course, well, he was Italian. Well, there was no Italy, actually. He was from Genoa. I actually got into it with some Italians about that, but we'll wait on that.
I wanted to go back and ask a question about, I think when you were speaking, you were referring to the standard text, I think is the name you gave it, when you were talking about American, like our outrage, you know, that we're not outraged at the actions.
David Stannard.
Stannard.
Who wrote a book called American Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, do you buy into his theory that it was that we are not as outraged because of the worthiness of the victims versus I was thinking that maybe part of the reason that we're not so outraged is because if for us to be outraged, then makes us as a nation have to feel guilty. And I think that might have something to do with it also, whereas it's easy for us to be outraged at the Nazis because we don't have to feel guilty as much about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we're not outraged right now about the genocides going on around the world because we're not doing anything about it, so we have to feel guilty about that. So I think there's something there also. Maybe.
Yeah, no, that's certainly that's what I meant about, you know, how do we deal with Columbus? He's sort of part of our family, and it's harder to deal with outrage in our own family. I mean, it's easy to point across the street and say, oh, look at that guy, he's really abusive to his wife, and so on, or look what happened in Germany, etc. So part of it, you're exactly right, is that how it affects us and our sense of guilt, but also Stannard's argument is that whites rank higher in the world than people of color. All right, our conception that European Jews killed in World War II are white Europeans. And we don't think, for example, that. And part of it is the understandable, powerful work done to remind people. I mean, Elie Wiesel is one of them, to remind people what happened. I knew virtually nothing about what happened to the Roma gypsies until I started reading, because there are no really viable spokespeople of that stature in the United States. So Stannard's argument is that even within horror, we rank people. So it's the guilt and the closeness, and we rank people in terms of race, in terms of gender, and so that some people become more worthy victims than others. I mean, it's a tragic, I think he'd argue it's a tragic fact. Yeah.
I have a question. I'm completely ignorant of history, so hence the question. Whatever rationale Columbus used to come over here and do what he did, he had to get people to do it. And so the guys who came over and like did all the work of conquesting the United States, were they mostly indentured servants and had to come, or were they promised some, you know, incredible better life, and once they got here, oh, by the way, in order to do this, you're going to have to get out there and kill people and risk your lives, and it's not as, the streets are not paved with gold. What was the rationale given to the people doing all the work of conquesting the United States, getting them over here from Europe?
Well, as far as I understand, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the crews on these ships were men. They were working men. They were poor men. They were not the the hoi polloi who were in the salons, listening to wonderful chamber music, etc., or whatever. Baroque, is that the Baroque period, the late 15th century? There was an expectation that they were going to get riches, the riches of the New World. Though, as far as I understand from the reading I've done, the average guy in that ship, and some of them died, as they went into the New World from disease, they didn't really profit that much. And from what we know about Columbus, he didn't personally do that great himself. But then as more and more ships and conquerors come from Europe, they come back with gold, slaves, and it's clear, to go back to Zach's point, that they're coming back with something. Human cargo, before that when people used to go to the East, spices, etc., but they're coming back with gold, they're coming back with silver. And by the way, one of the amazing historic coincidences of this is, and I believe it's the same week, but it certainly is the same month. Columbus, those three ships leave, I think it was Cadiz, Spain, in August 1492. At the same time, ships are leaving that harbor carrying Jews who've been expelled from Spain. Because many years ago, I was chair of the Human Rights Commission in Ithaca, New York. We worked with the American Indian Program on the quincentennial, Columbus. We did things in schools and had meetings, and some of us attended that conference I mentioned. And the rabbi then at Cornell University did a wonderful lecture for us in a community hall downtown Ithaca about the connection of Columbus and Jews at the same time leaving Spain. Columbus to come to the New World, Jews being expelled, and some, by the way, in terms of a long, amazing historical journey, ending up in the Southwest United States many, generations later. But some clearly profited. There's no doubt about that. Especially the kings and the queens and the, some of them, they used to impress, that may have been later, they used to just grab people. But I think part of it is the conditions facing folks at that time, again, males, facing difficult circumstances.
I also would like to point out that what they did then is just how they promoted it to us. How our history tells it, that these people were heathens, they were primitives, and so forth. Well, this is what we do today to the young students in high school. We tell them all kinds of terrible things about what's happening over Iraq. They tell them all kinds of lies and things like that. But the one thing I wanted to say is that, first of all, I really think that Americans in particular are kind of idealists, and they like to idealize and see themselves as some sort of conquering, some sort of a hero in some way. And it seems to me, you hear all the time about we're going to bring democracy to Iraq or something like that. We don't even have democracy here, and we haven't had democracy here in years. Did we ever have democracy here?
Well, because that's whole other issue. We will get to
it. If you have seen the film...
When did we get it?
Okay. U.S. What I've learned about U.S. foreign policy, and you see how we went in through all these countries from back in Iran in 1953. Where's the democracy here? All the politicians are paid by the corporations, so...
But we're not, this. We don't want to make this a, you'll see from Zinn's book, this is not a U.S. bashing book, because there's also a lot of resistance and wonderful things happening, is that, quote-unquote, Americans are not unique. If you read the history, for example, I mean, I talked a little bit about, you know, it's the 30th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. If you read about the French in Vietnam, and if you read about the English, you know, the Brits going to China, and you read all sorts of, it happened to be Europeans, the Italians going to Ethiopia and going to Libya, that is the same notion that they are bringing to these, you know, huddled masses, civilization, you know, music, you know, Vivaldi, whatever. But it's so that whole, I mean, that's gone on. I mean, we think about, and the Dutch in what, you know, is now Indonesia. And so all of the major European powers have done this. They're bringing, you know, the French, we're going to bring you the, you know, we're the seat of revolution and, you know, Rousseau and Voltaire, and we're going to bring all this stuff to you. And, of course, they try to hook, I don't know how many tens of thousands of Vietnamese on drugs. The Brits in China, I mean, you know, we all learned about Queen Victoria, right? The Victorian age. She was the biggest dope dealer of the 19th century. I mean, just read about the opium wars in China. The Brits went in and fought two wars to make sure that they were going to keep those people, you know, hooked on dope. So U.S. is not unique in this regard. And we're actually kind of late in this, you know, I mean, we're, even though we have one long regime. But it's again, what are they going for? Zach said, I mean, what do they really want? I mean, you know, think about it here in the U.S., land. Okay, land and riches, and then we were talking during the break. Some of you are familiar with Buffy St. Marie's wonderful song, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee, Our People Are Dying," about, you know, you exploit us and you kill us and you take our land, then you develop the story. We learned the story. We read the textbooks. We saw the movies. I mean, I'm older than most people here. And, you know, the John Wayne movies and freeing the West and keeping white women safe and The Last of the Mohegans with Henry Fonda as an Indian. I mean, you know, I didn't see the more recent one with Daniel Day-Lewis, but that's the story we learned. And if you're not helped to have some critical tools, a filter, so I can understand, I just take it in. And then that's why my students, when they used to read Zinn's book, wow, were they pissed off at me. Man, I used to tell them, you know, I'm just a bear of bad news. I said, the Greeks used to actually kill the bears of bad news, but I hope that they wouldn't do that to me. But because they didn't know this stuff. And then when they knew it, they were angry. Okay, and why didn't we learn this? And it's not about our neurons. I mean, this is not rocket science here. I mean, we know this stuff. It's easy. You know, it's not a complicated thing, really. So we, quote, the U.S., doing, and right, we're always going everywhere doing good in the world. I mean, how else? What are you going to do? Get up and say, we're going here because we're going to screw these people over. We're going there because they're terrible. We're going to stomp on them. I mean, because then people would say, wait a minute, well, why are we doing this? So we have to always do it for the good of the people that we're messing over. You know, that's, remember your mother? Did your mother ever give you a castor oil or something? Say, it's good for you. You know, drink this stuff. Well, maybe not.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to ask a little bit, because I don't have a lot of knowledge, but as I understood it in the Central American countries that also got conquered after Columbus, you know, came and visited everywhere, that there were a lot of cultures there that weren't necessarily like the Native American cultures further north, that were more warlike, that engaged in human sacrifice, wore pelts of human flesh, and took slaves themselves from warring tribes. And you did touch on that they had their own conflicts and wars, but and it's depicted in their art. You know, you see lots of, you know, old pieces of art that have been discovered in digs that they were, some were a very violent people and brutal and cannibalistic. And so you can, I mean, you can see the jump or the reason that the, you know, the lurid things always get told over and over again. You know, I mean, look at the 6 o'clock news. It's always bad, right? How that barbaric kind of face could be easily put on the indigenous people here, and how that would reinforce the beliefs of the people committing the atrocities coming over from Europe, that it is for their own good. It is to save their souls from their pagan religion. The fundamental belief that you're not just of this earth, you're going to go on to heaven or hell or whatever it is, was maybe something that made it worth the life of their current slave, you know, in their own mind. I mean, as far as a rationalization goes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I just thought I'd bring it up because it is hard to see how any human being could come and commit such atrocities to such a peaceful people. So there must have been a little something there, you know, within everything that they were observing to help the rationalization. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, it, you know, we're pretty equal across the board. There have always been wars in every culture, and we're observing one culture's kind of supremacist view. And like we touched on earlier with the Roman Empire and the Crusades, that this is stuff that's been going on for a long, long time. And, you know, maybe it's part of human nature or not. Maybe it's something that human nature can breed out of itself. I would hope so for the future, you know. Anyway, just wanted to make that.
No, that's a very, you know, excellent point. So we can't romanticize what was going on in various cultures, that everybody was sweet and wonderful, and because extraordinary things in terms of the Aztecs and yeah, Mexico, what is now Mexico and Central America. No, thank you for sharing that.
Hi. Got a couple of things, disparate things, but one thing. Little incident that came to mind when we're talking about the first contact of Europeans with Americans, you know, people of the continents. In the Norse sagas or the Greenlander sagas, it actually tells. I mean, it's quite interesting to read this stuff and then say, "Wow, this was, as far as we know, the very first contact between essentially European and an American, someone from the continents." And you know, the guys identified, you know. Torvin Carl Sevni is like 1000, you know, AD in Newfoundland, and you know they write how the very first contact. So while and they were there not for gold, apparently they were there because you know it's crowded in Greenland and greener pastures, you know, literally. But the first contact was him walking along a beach in Newfoundland and seeing a canoe. Right? I mean, they had signs, distant signs that there are native inhabitants there. They called them skraelings, that word, Scandinavian word, skraelings, whatever that meant. And underneath the canoe were like several, I think there were like, it was a big canoe. I think there were six natives sleeping, you know, skraeling, sleeping on the beach under this canoe, daytime. And what Torfsen Karlsenis does is turns the canoe over and he kills them. And it's like reading this thing. It was like, wait a minute! This is the first. This is the very first contact, we know of between a European and an American, you know, a Native American. It's like, you know, and they, you know, at that point, Christianity was just beginning to reach and hold on to Scandinavian, but very unlikely it had much of a hold on these guys. You know, but so, you know, that is a motive. And gold wasn't so much, you know, avarice maybe wasn't, but that was the response.
Wow.
You know?
Well, I've never, that's incredible. I mean, not to make light of it, but you could almost hear George Carlin telling that story. If they come across the canoe and you lift the canoe up and the guys say, hey, aren't you guys working? Aren't you going to do anything?
Right,
and then they
right,
get together
right.
and hang out. Because in human nature, to go back to the notion of human nature is as humans have done, which means in the contact, because Columbus tells us, the Taino, were willing to give them everything. I mean, they were happy. They would give them everything. They didn't even know about swords. They cut themselves. They didn't want anything. They were generous. So in the struggle of humans, we've had the most absolutely horrific thing. I mean, who could even imagine some of the things that have been done? And then people coming together and, oh, you know, and they know they look different, and these guys have canoes, and some people didn't have clothes, and though in Newfoundland they would have had clothes, it probably was, it's always chilly up in Newfoundland, and but it's amazing the possibilities, but wow, that's a chilling, oh my God.
And just another quick, I know it's a disparate thought was, you know, when you were talking earlier about what we're talking about here is that we ourselves, you know, we are having to do our own truth commission. You know, like America is having to do its own truth commission. And we think of Burundi, Rwanda, you know, truth commission, South Africa truth. We're having to do our own truth commission, and we as a culture have never been willing to do our own truth commission. And that's, and maybe it's not, maybe that's the fundamental point, because it's maybe not like we're so much worse or better than other countries that have done these things, but that's our, maybe that's every nation's or culture's task, perhaps, if we're going to change the way things are going, is for us to do our own truth commission.
I've never heard it actually, Curtis, put that way, but it's very profound and moving because, for example, having worked with Vietnam veterans who then went back to Vietnam and met people in the villages where they were, where they actually fought, and saying that you need to somehow confront things and admit things as a way of healing. And that you're right, we've never had, there have been a few things. There was the $20,000 given to the descendants of those and remaining survivors of those who were interned in the camps during World War II, Japanese Americans. In fact, they have actually, this will be a ceremony, April 30th, this Saturday at Manzanar near Lone Pine. But we really haven't done that for what happened in this history vis-a-vis slavery and American Indians. And to open that up, on one hand, would be very controversial. On the other hand, how else do you begin to heal the past and move on?
If we ever decide to start a truth commission, I would suggest that to start working from today, going backward, rather than going from 500 years ago and coming forward. I think we have a lot to investigate, especially with what's going on in Iraq and so many hundreds of thousands, I don't know how many civilians, death and so forth. John, I was just going to ask you a question about, is there such a thing as progress in history? We read things about 500 years ago, and we see the same things almost happening today, more efficiently, better technologies, but the attitudes and ideas are almost the same. I mean, the fact that we say we don't count Iraqi civilians is because they are less than us, and so they don't matter. And this is exactly what we see in these history books and so forth. So is there a progress in history?
Well, maybe some people want to respond to that question. I'd be happy to do it, but let's stay on that. I mean, any thoughts that some of you have about Taraj's question?
No, we're not progressing. The people, it doesn't matter if it's Christopher Columbus who told Rodrigo, no, I saw land the night before, so you don't get the reward. And it doesn't matter now if it's the John Welch's of General Electric. They're all the same. The American people have been marginalized, were slapped in the face constantly. And
the truth of the matter is we're not progressing. You and I that sit here tonight are progressing. But go out tonight and talk to two or three people at any coffee bar, and they're going to look at you and go, gee, aren't you worried about the Dodgers? They're not going to sit down and talk about the fact that the young American soldiers have wiped out 100,000, have raped, have killed, have brutalized, have stuck metal pipes up people's rear ends. They're not going to talk about that, but they are going to talk this morning on Headline News about a corporal that did some kind of wonderful heroic thing that saved some other men in his battalion. That is where we're at. Multi-corporations are controlling everything. It's not Christopher Columbus now. It's General Electric. It's Raytheon. It's Northrop. It's Boeing. Are we going to make progress? No.
Well, but at the same time, Zinn's argument about the cost of human progress. There has been progress in human history the last 500 years in a number of areas. But at the same time, he's really asking us, I mean, we had immense technological progress, but at what price, what human price, which the people who were enslaved on those islands and in this, what is now the United States, were not ever asked freely to make that choice. You know, would you like to be sort of a victim in this amazing human progress, because you're going to work the land to create the wealth, which is going to build the cities, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a two-sided coin. That those things that some of us may take for granted that have opened up possibilities in the world, not just technologically, the human tragedy and cost of that progress is staggering. And, of course, when I used to have discussions with my students, they'd say, well, you know, a lot of people did things like that then in the 15th century. And I'd have to walk through with them the 20th century. You're right. We know a lot more. We have a lot more knowledge about the world, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the 20th century was the most awesome, bloodiest, extraordinarily violent. I mean, it's incredible. And we have the means of doing things that Columbus and his men couldn't even imagine. So in some ways, we haven't, you know, we haven't gone anywhere.
Okay, well, I wanted to respond to, there were a few comments about how could Columbus have recruited, or how could anybody, you know, go on a journey to, you know, to commit genocide. And my comment was that Columbus wasn't going to commit genocide. Right. He was going to India. Suppose that instead of having met these guileless Arawak people who were ready to give him anything, he had reached his destination and had the shrewd, experienced, seasoned Indian spice traders to contend with, and he'd simply gone, done his shopping, and come home.
Yeah, right. No, you're right. He didn't set out to do the first voyage, but you know, when they came back, and made sure they took slaves, et cetera, et cetera. Then, because they knew what they had done the first voyage, but you're right. People start and right. He thought he was somewhere, and he wasn't. And the whole other thing. Remember, we learned, well, Columbus proved the earth wasn't flat. People knew this long before Columbus. I mean, who invented that thing?
Washington Irving.
Well, he was the one who wrote that book about somebody being asleep for 20 years. Are you going to trust him? Yeah.
What if he, you know, had just ended up in his original destination and had found these, you know, spice traders in India? As Zinn points out, on a side note, he never would have made it there. He was lucky he found land, because another 30 days, if the ocean wasn't as big as he thought it was, they would have all been dead at sea. So it was sort of...
Yeah. We're going to give this gentleman the final word tonight.
Wow.
Well, we have to...
I get scared.
Get the chairs back and everything. Yeah.
And then let me try to make a kind of a wrap-up then. I think we should stay on the chapter Columbus, etc., but at the same time, your comment about going backwards, it has a very important historical thing, which is
Most often we look at the history to understand ourselves today. It helps a lot. So from this point of view, it's very good to go backwards, but also when you look at all the history, you have to keep looking at what is the impact of this now? What does this teach for me, to my life, to my society? As far as the society goes, you are a professor, understand, me too. We know that the classes, they have personalities, which is not just the sum of the people. They behave differently. Anybody who taught a class for several classes for a few years, we know that. Now, the society is also, I believe, is the same. The American society happens to be, unfortunately, a particularly aggressive one. This probably has things to do with the Christianity, which is not a very good religion or a superstition, but it is a very aggressive. I came from Brazil, so I can compare societies since I have lived 28 years there and 30 years here. So now, but then what can we do? If people are in this society, we have to think, okay, what can we do with this? We cannot justify and say because the others are aggressive too, like you said, because as the lady there said, it does not justify that other people have done similar things. For one thing, as far as I know, no society have done as bad as the United States have done. So it do not justify to begin with. But then have to see, what moral can we take out of this? My opinion then, because I have to close now then, is that one thing that comes from the Romans, power is very dangerous. At one time, I became a director of the electronics program where I used to teach, and I was very scared because I got power. And I know that power corrupts, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous for the other and for me, because then I can destroy myself for losing my humanity and think that I'm a good guy, blah, 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 which I'm not. Nobody is. We always do what we can, given to our past and so on. So on top of the United States being powerful and having a history of aggression and so on, there is the other danger that it happened to have become very powerful. And then it created, this is a very particularly dangerous and bad brew. And then what came out, I think, is awful, no? When I look back at the history, I don't see a society that have done as much damage.
Yeah.
Not only for people, but for the environment, and maybe destroying the whole thing and so on. But we have tried then to fix it as much as we can. Sometimes I get desperate because I feel sad, but then all we have to do is in every step that we do whatever we can to make it better. And maybe we don't fix it, but then at least when we die, you say, okay, I did all I could.
Well, your comment about power, and let's end on that, that without the ability to actually do these things, of course, the history would have been different. I mean, you might have this idea, we want to conquer all these people, we want to do this, we want to take all their gold, their land, but if you can't do that, different.
You have been listening to a discussion of Chapter 1 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, led by Dr. John Marciano. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web, lasoundposse.org.
And we'll continue this series on a bi-monthly basis. You can download this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests from our web archive at our site, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening, and I wish you a hell-raising, love-filled, and creative New Year.